You may continue, Speaker Gendebaugh. Let me point out to the table that the conviction of an impeached speaker is so weighty and indeed unprecedented an action that we dare not give the appearance of not allowing a full defense. Remember, too, that even if the verdict satisfies us, it may not satisfy those who come after us, and I cannot believe that a second foundationer of any level, let alone the speakers of the table, would not have a full appreciation of the importance of historical perspective. Let us so act that we can be certain of the approval of the speakers who will follow us in the coming centuries. Delarmy said bitterly,
We run the risk, First Speaker, of having posterity laugh at us for belaboring the obvious. To continue the defense is your decision.
Gendebaugh drew a deep breath. In line with your decision, then, First Speaker, I wish to call a witness. A young woman I met 3 days ago, and without whom I might not have reached the table meeting at all, instead of merely being late.
Is the woman you speak of known to the table? Asked the First Speaker.
No, First Speaker. She is a native to this planet. Delarmy's eyes opened wide.
A Hamish woman?
Indeed, just so. Delarmy said,
What have we to do with one of those? Nothing they say can be of any importance. They don't exist.
Gendebaugh's lips drew back tightly over his teeth in something that could not possibly have been mistaken for a smile. He said sharply, Physically, all the Hamish exist. They are human beings and play their part in Selden's plan. In their indirect protection of the Second Foundation, they play a crucial part. I wish to dissociate myself from Speaker Delarmy's inhumanity and hope that her remark will be retained in the record and be considered hereafter as evidence for her possible unfitness for the position of Speaker. Will the rest of the table agree with the Speaker's incredible remark and deprive me of my witness? The First Speaker said,
Call your witness, Speaker.
Gendebaugh's lips relaxed into the normal, expressionless features of a speaker under pressure. His mind was guarded and fenced in, but behind this protective barrier he felt that the danger point had passed, and that he had won. 34. Surinovi looked strained. Her eyes were wide, and her lower lip was faintly trembling. Her hands were slowly clenching and unclenching, and her chest was heaving slightly. Her hair had been pulled back and braided into a bun. Her sun-darkened face twitched now and then. Her hands fumbled at the pleats of her long skirt. She looked hastily around the table from speaker to speaker, her wide eyes filled with awe. They glanced back at her with varying degrees of contempt and discomfort. Delarmy kept her eyes well above the top of Novi's head, oblivious to her presence. Carefully, Gendebaugh touched the skin of her mind, soothing and relaxing it. He might have done the same by patting her hand or stroking her cheek, but here, under these circumstances, that was impossible, of course. He said, First Speaker, I am numbing this woman's conscious awareness so that her testimony will not be distorted by fear. Will you please observe? Will the rest of you, if you wish, join me, and observe that I will in no way modify her mind? Novi had started back in terror at Gendebaugh's voice, and Gendebaugh was not surprised at that. He realized that she had never heard Second Foundationers of high rank speak among themselves. She had never experienced that odd, swift combination of sound, tone, expression, and thought. The terror, however, faded as quickly as it came, as he gentled her mind. A look of placidity crossed her face. There is a chair behind you, Novi, Gendebaugh said. Please sit down. Novi curtsied in a small and clumsy manner and sat down, holding herself stiffly. She talked quite clearly, but Gendebaugh made her repeat when her Hamish accent became too thick. And because he kept his own speech formal in deference to the table, he occasionally had to repeat his own questions to her. The tale of the fight between himself and Rufirant was described quietly and well. Gendebaugh said, Did you see all this yourself, Novi?
Nay, master, or I would have sooner stopped it. Rufirant be good fellow, but not quick in head.
But you described it all. How is that possible if you did not see it all?
Rufirant be telling me thereof, unquestioning. He be ashamed.
Ashamed? Have you ever known him to behave in this manner in earlier times?
Rufirant? Nay, master, he be gentle, though he be large. He be no fighter, and he be afeard of scowlers. He say often they are mighty and possessive power.
Why didn't he feel this way when he met me?
It be strange. It be not understood.
She shook her head.
He be not his ain self. I said to him, Thou blubberhead, be it your place to assault scowler? And he said, I know not how it happened. It be like I am on one side standing and watching, not I.
Speaker Cheng interrupted.
First Speaker, of what value is it to have this woman report what a man has told her? Is not the man available for questioning?
Gendebaugh said, He is. If on completion of this woman's testimony the table wishes to hear more evidence, I will be ready to call Carol Rufirant, my recent antagonist, to the stand. If not, the table can move directly to judgment when I am done with this witness.
Very well, said the first speaker. Proceed with your witness.
Gendebal said, And you, Novi, was it like you to interfere in a fight in this manner? Novi did not say anything for a moment. A small frown appeared between her thick eyebrows and then disappeared. She said,
I know not. I wish no harm to scowlers. I be driven, and without thought I enmeddled myself.
A pause, then.
I be do it over if need arise.
Gendebal said, Novi, you will sleep now. You will think of nothing. You will rest, and you will not even dream. Novi mumbled for a moment. Her eyes closed, and her head fell back against the headrest of her chair. Gendebal waited a moment, then said, First speaker, with respect, follow me into this woman's mind. You will find it remarkably simple and symmetrical, which is fortunate, for what you will see might not have been visible otherwise. Here. Here. Do you observe? If the rest of you will enter, it will be easier if it is done one at a time. There was a rising buzz about the table. Gendebal said, Is there any doubt among you? Delarmy said,
I doubt it, for...
She paused on the brink of what was, even for her, unsayable. Gendebal said it for her. You think I deliberately tampered with this mind in order to present false evidence? You think, therefore, that I am capable of bringing about so delicate an adjustment, one mental fiber clearly out of shape, with nothing about it or its surroundings that is in the least disturbed? If I could do that, what need would I have to deal with any of you in this manner? Why subject myself to the indignity of a trial? Why labor to convince you? If I could do what is visible in this woman's mind, you would all be helpless before me, unless you were well prepared. The blunt fact is that none of you could manipulate a mind as this woman's has been manipulated. Neither can I. Yet it has been done. He paused, looking at all the speakers in turn, then fixing his gaze on Delarmy. He spoke slowly. Now, if anything more is required, I will call in the Hamish farmer, Carol Rufirant, whom I have examined, and whose mind has also been tampered with in this manner.
That will not be necessary, said the first speaker, who was wearing an appalled expression. What we have seen is mind-shaking.
In that case, said Gendebal, may I rouse this Hamish woman and dismiss her? I have arranged for there to be those outside who will see to her recovery. When Novi had left, directed by Gendebal's gentle hold on her elbow, he said, Let me quickly summarize. Minds can be, and have been, altered in ways that are beyond our power. In this way, the curators themselves could have been influenced to remove earth material from the library, without our knowledge or their own. We see how it was arranged that I should be delayed in arriving at a meeting of the table. I was threatened. I was rescued. The result was that I was impeached. The result of this apparently natural concatenation of events is that I may be removed from a position of power, and the course of action which I champion, and which threatens these people, whoever they are, may be negated. Delarmy leaned forward. She was clearly shaken.
If this secret organization is so clever, how were you able to discover all this?
Gendebal felt free to smile now. No credit to me, he said. I lay no claim to expertise superior to that of other speakers, certainly not to the first speaker. However, neither are these anti-mules, as the first speaker has rather engagingly called them, infinitely wise or infinitely immune to circumstance. Perhaps they chose this particular Hamish woman as their instrument precisely because she needed very little adjustment. She was, of her own character, sympathetic to what she calls scholars, and admired them intensely. But then, once this was over, her momentary contact with me strengthened her fantasy of becoming a scholar herself. She came to me the next day with that purpose in mind. Curious at this peculiar ambition of hers, I studied her mind, which I certainly would not otherwise have done, and, more by accident than anything else, stumbled upon the adjustment and noted its significance. Had another woman been chosen, one with a less natural pro-scholar bias, the anti-mules might have had to labor more at the adjustment, but the consequences might well not have followed, and I would have remained ignorant of all this. The anti-mules miscalculated, or could not sufficiently allow for the unforeseen. That they can stumble so is heartening. Delarmy said,
The first speaker and you call this organization the anti-mules, I presume, because they seem to labor to keep the galaxy in the path of the Selden plan, rather than to disrupt it as the mule himself did. If the anti-mules do this, why are they dangerous?
Why should they labor, if not for some purpose? We don't know what that purpose is. A cynic might say that they intend to step in at some future time and turn the current in another direction, one that may please them far more than it would please us. That is my own feeling, even though I do not major in cynicism. Is Speaker Delarmy prepared to maintain, out of the love and trust that we all know form so great a part of her character, that these are cosmic altruists doing our work for us without dream of reward? There was a gentle susurration of laughter about the table at this, and Jendebal knew that he had won. And Delarmy knew that she had lost, for there was a wash of rage that showed through her harsh metallic control like a momentary ray of ruddy sunlight through a thick canopy of leaves. Jendebal said, "When I first experienced the incident with the Hamish farmer, I leaped to the conclusion that another speaker was behind it. When I noted the adjustment of the Hamish woman's mind, I knew that I was right as to the plot, but wrong as to the plotter. I apologize for the misinterpretation, and I plead the circumstances as an extenuation." The first speaker said, "I believe this may be construed as an apology." Delarmy interrupted. She was quite placid again. Her face was friendly, her voice downright saccharine. "With total respect, first speaker, if I may interrupt, let us drop this matter of impeachment. At this moment, I would not vote for conviction, and I imagine no one will. I would even suggest the impeachment be stricken from the speaker's unblemished record. Speaker Jendebal has exonerated himself ably. I congratulate him on that, and for uncovering a crisis that the rest of us might well have allowed to smolder on indefinitely with incalculable results. I offer the speaker my wholehearted apologies for my earlier hostility." She virtually beamed at Jendebal, who felt a reluctant admiration for the manner in which she shifted direction instantly in order to cut her losses. He also felt that all this was but preliminary to an attack from a new direction. He was certain that what was coming would not be pleasant. 35. When she exerted herself to be charming, Speaker Delora Delarmy had a way of dominating the speaker's table. Her voice grew soft, her smile indulgent, her eyes sparkling, all of her sweet. No one cared to interrupt her, and everyone waited for the blow to fall. She said, "Thanks to Speaker Jendebal, I think we all now understand what we must do. We do not see the anti-mules. We know nothing about them, except for their fugitive touches on the minds of people right here in the stronghold of the Second Foundation itself. We do not know what the power center of the First Foundation is planning. We may face an alliance of the anti-mules and the First Foundation. We don't know. We do know that this Golan Treviz and his companion, whose name escapes me at the moment, are going we know not where, and that the first speaker and Jendebal feel that Treviz holds the key to the outcome of this great crisis. What then are we to do? Clearly, we must find out everything we can about Treviz, where he is going, what he is thinking, what his purpose may be, or, indeed, whether he has any destination, any thought, any purpose, whether he might not, in fact, be a mere tool of a force greater than he." Jendebal said, "He is under observation." Delarmy pursed her lips in an indulgent smile. "By whom? By one of our outworld agents? Are such agents to be expected to stand against those with the powers we have seen demonstrated here? Surely not. In the Mule's time, and later on, too, the Second Foundation did not hesitate to send out, and even to sacrifice, volunteers from among the best we had, since nothing less would do. When it was necessary to restore the Selden plan, Bream Palver himself scoured the galaxy as a Trantorian traitor in order to bring back that girl, Arkady. We cannot sit here and wait now, when the crisis may be greater than in either previous case. We cannot rely on minor functionaries, watchers, and messenger boys." Jendebal said, "Surely you are not suggesting that the first speaker leave Trantor at this time?" Delarmy said, "Certainly not. We need him badly here. On the other hand, there is you, Speaker Jendebal. It is you who have correctly sensed and weighed the crisis. It is you who detected the subtle outside interference with the library and with Hamish Mines. It is you who have maintained your views against the united opposition of the table and won. No one here has seen as clearly as you have, and no one can be trusted as you can to continue to see clearly. It is you who must, in my opinion, go out to confront the enemy. May I have the sense of the table?" There was no formal vote needed to reveal that sense. Each speaker felt the minds of the others, and it was clear to a suddenly appalled Jendebal that, at the moment of his victory and Delarmy's defeat, this formidable woman was managing to send him irrevocably into exile on a task that might occupy him for some indefinite period, while she remained behind to control the table, and therefore the Second Foundation, and therefore the galaxy, sending all alike, perhaps, to their doom. And if Jendebal in exile should somehow manage to gather the information that would enable the Second Foundation to avert the gathering crisis, it would be Delarmy who would have the credit for having arranged it, and his success would but confirm her power. The quicker Jendebal would be, the more efficiently he succeeded, the more surely he would confirm her power. It was a beautiful maneuver, an unbelievable recovery. And so clearly was she dominating the table even now that she was virtually usurping the first speaker's role. Jendebal's thought to that effect was overtaken by the rage he sensed from the first speaker. He turned. The first speaker was making no effort to hide his anger, and it soon was clear that another internal crisis was building to replace the one that had been resolved. 36. Quindoshendis, the 25th first speaker, had no extraordinary illusions about himself. He knew he was not one of those few dynamic first speakers who had illuminated the 5-century-long history of the Second Foundation, but then he didn't have to be. He controlled the table in a quiet period of galactic prosperity, and it was not a time for dynamism. It had seemed to be a time to play a holding game, and he had been the man for this role. His predecessor had chosen him for that reason. "You are not an adventurer, you are a scholar," the 24th first speaker had said. "You will preserve the plan, where an adventurer might ruin it." Preserve. Let that be the key word for your table. He had tried, but it had meant a passive first speakership, and this had been on occasion interpreted as weakness. There had been recurrent rumors that he meant to resign, and there had been open intrigue to assure the succession in one direction or another. There was no doubt in Chandis's mind that Delarmy had been a leader in the fight. She was the strongest personality at the table, and even Jendebal, with all the fire and folly of youth, retreated before her, as he was doing right now. But by Selden, passive he might be, or even weak, but there was one prerogative of the first speaker that not one in the line had ever given up, and neither would he do so. He rose to speak, and at once there was a hush about the table. When the first speaker rose to speak, there could be no interruptions. Even Delarmy or Jendebal would not dare to interrupt. He said, "Speakers, I agree that we face a dangerous crisis, and that we must take strong measures. It is I who should go out to meet the enemy. Speaker Delarmy, with the gentleness that characterizes her, excuses me from the task by stating that I am needed here. The truth, however, is that I am needed neither here nor there. I grow old. I grow weary. There has long been expectation I would someday resign, and perhaps I ought to. When this crisis is successfully surmounted, I shall resign. But, of course, it is the privilege of the first speaker to choose his successor. I am going to do so now. There is one speaker who has long dominated the proceedings of the table, one speaker who, by force of personality, has often supplied the leadership that I could not. You all know I am speaking of Speaker Delarmy." He paused, then said, "You alone, Speaker Jendebal, are registering disapproval. May I ask why?" He sat down so that Jendebal might have the right to answer. "I do not disapprove, First Speaker," said Jendebal in a low voice. "It is your prerogative to choose your successor." "And so I will. When you return, having succeeded in initiating the process that will put an end to this crisis, it will be time for my resignation. My successor will then be directly in charge of conducting whatever policies may be required to carry on and complete that process. Do you have anything to say, Speaker Jendebal?" Jendebal said quietly, "When you make Speaker Delarmy your successor, First Speaker, I hope you will see fit to advise her to..." The First Speaker interrupted him roughly. "I have spoken of Speaker Delarmy, but I have not named her as my successor. Now, what do you have to say?" "My apologies, First Speaker. I should have said, assuming you make Speaker Delarmy your successor upon my return from this mission, would you see fit to advise her?" "Nor will I make her my successor in the future under any conditions. Now, what do you have to say?" The first speaker was unable to make this announcement without a stab of satisfaction at the blow he was delivering to Delarmy. He could not have done it in a more humiliating fashion. "Well, Speaker Jendebal," he said, "what do you have to say?" "That I am confused." The first speaker rose again. He said, "Speaker Delarmy has dominated and led, but that is not all that is needed for the post of first speaker. Speaker Jendebal has seen what we have not seen. He has faced the united hostility of the table and forced it to rethink matters and has dragged it into agreement with him. I have my suspicions as to the motivation of Speaker Delarmy in placing the responsibility of the pursuit of Golan Trevis on the shoulders of Speaker Jendebal, but that is where the burden belongs. I know he will succeed. I trust my intuition in this. And when he returns, Speaker Jendebal will become the 26th first speaker." He sat down abruptly, and each speaker began to make clear his opinion in a bedlam of sound, tone, thought, and expression. The first speaker paid no attention to the cacophony, but stared indifferently before him. Now that it was done, he realized, with some surprise, the great comfort there was in laying down the mantle of responsibility. He should have done it before this, but he couldn't have. It was not till now that he had found his obvious successor. And then, somehow, his mind caught that of Delarmy, and he looked up at her. By Selden. She was calm and smiling. Her desperate disappointment did not show. She had not given up. He wondered if he had played into her hands. What was there left for her to do? 37. Delora Delarmy would freely have shown her desperation and disappointment if that would have proven of any use whatever. It would have given her a great deal of satisfaction to strike out at that senile fool who controlled the table, or at that juvenile idiot with whom fortune had conspired. But satisfaction wasn't what she wanted. She wanted something more. She wanted to be first speaker. And while there was a card left to play, she would play it. She smiled gently and managed to lift her hand as though she were about to speak, and then held the pose just long enough to ensure that when she did speak, all would be not merely normal, but radiantly quiet. She said, "First Speaker, as Speaker Gendebal said earlier, I do not disapprove. It is your prerogative to choose your successor. If I speak now, it is in order that I may contribute, I hope, to the success of what has now become Speaker Gendebal's mission. May I explain my thoughts, First Speaker?"
"Do so," said the First Speaker curtly. She was entirely too smooth, too pliant, it seemed to him.
Delarmy bent her head gravely. She no longer smiled. She said,
"We have ships. They are not as technologically magnificent as those of the First Foundation, but they will carry Speaker Gendebal. He knows how to pilot one, I believe, as do we all. We have our representatives on every major planet in the galaxy, and he will be welcomed everywhere. Moreover, he can defend himself against even these anti-mules now that he is thoroughly aware of the danger. Even when we were unaware, I suspect they have preferred to work through the lower classes, and even the Hamish farmers. We will, of course, thoroughly inspect the minds of all the Second Foundationers, including the speakers, but I am sure they have remained inviolate. The anti-mules did not dare interfere with us. Nevertheless, there is no reason why Speaker Gendebal should risk more than he must. He is not intending to engage in daring do, and it will be best if his mission is to some extent disguised, if he takes them unaware. It will be useful if he goes in the role of a Hamish trader. Preem Palver, we all know, went off into the galaxy as a supposed trader."
The First Speaker said, "Preem Palver had a specific purpose in doing so. Speaker Gendebal has not. If it appears a disguise of some sort is necessary, I am sure he will be ingenious enough to adopt one."
"With respect, First Speaker, I wish to point out a subtle disguise. Preem Palver, you will remember, took with him his wife and companion of many years. Nothing so thoroughly established the rustic nature of his character as the fact that he was traveling with his wife. It allayed all suspicion."
Gendebal said, "I have no wife. I have had companions, but none who would now volunteer to assume the marital role."
"This is well known, Speaker Gendebal," said Delarmy. "But then, people will take the role for granted if any woman is with you. Surely some volunteer can be found, and if you feel the need to be able to present documentary evidence, that can be provided. I think a woman should come with you."
For a moment, Gendebal was breathless. Surely she did not mean... Could it be a ploy to achieve a share in this success? Could she be playing for a joint or rotating occupation of the First Speakership? Gendebal said grimly, "I am flattered that Speaker Delarmy should feel that she..."
And Delarmy broke into an open laugh and looked at Gendebal with what was almost true affection. He had fallen into the trap and looked foolish for having done so. The table would not forget that.
She said, "Speaker Gendebal, I would not have the impertinence to attempt to share in this task. It is yours and yours alone, as the post of First Speaker will be yours and yours alone. I would not have thought you wanted me with you."
"Really, Speaker, at my age, I no longer think of myself as a charmer."
There were smiles around the table, and even the First Speaker tried to hide one. Gendebal felt the stroke and labored not to compound the loss by failing to match her lightness. It was labor lost. He said as unsavagely as he could, "Then what is it you would suggest? It was not in my thoughts, I assure you, that you would wish to accompany me. You are at your best at the table and not in the hurly-burly of galactic affairs, I know."
"I agree, Speaker Gendebal, I agree," said Delarmy. "My suggestion, however, refers back to your role as Hamish trader. To make it indisputably authentic, what better companion need you ask but a Hamish woman?"
"A Hamish woman?"
For a second time in rapid succession, Gendebal was caught by surprise, and the table enjoyed it.
"The Hamish woman," Delarmy went on, "the one who saved you from a beating, the one who gazes at you worshipfully, the one whose mind you probed, and who then quite unwittingly saved you a second time from considerably more than a beating.
I suggest you take her.
Jendabal's impulse was to refuse, but he knew that she expected that. It would mean more enjoyment for the table. It was clear now that the first speaker, anxious to strike out at Delarmy, had made a mistake by naming Jendabal his successor, or at the very least that Delarmy had quickly converted it into one. Jendabal was the youngest of the speakers. He had angered the table, and had then avoided conviction by them. In a very real way, he had humiliated them. None could see him as the heir apparent without resentment. That would have been hard enough to overcome, but now they would remember how easily Delarmy had twitched him into ridicule, and how much they had enjoyed it. She would use that to convince them all too easily that he lacked the age and experience for the role of first speaker. Their united pressure would force the first speaker into changing his decision while Jendabal was off on his mission. Or, if the first speaker held fast, Jendabal would eventually find himself with an office that would be forever helpless in the face of united opposition. He saw it all in an instant, and was able to answer as though without hesitation. He said, "Speaker Delarmy, I admire your insight. I had thought to surprise you all. It was indeed my intention to take the Hamish woman, though not quite for the very good reason you suggest. It was for her mind that I wished to take her with me. You have all examined that mind. You saw it for what it was, surprisingly intelligent, but more than that, clear, simple, utterly without guile. No touch upon it by others would go unnoticed, as I'm sure you all concluded. I wonder if it occurred to you then, Speaker Delarmy, that she would serve as an excellent early warning system. I would detect the first symptomatic presence of mentalism by way of her mind, earlier, I think, than by way of mine." There was a kind of astonished silence at that, and he said lightly, "Ah, none of you saw that. Well, well, not important. And I will take my leave now. There's no time to lose."
"Wait," said Delarmy, her initiative lost a third time. "What do you intend to do?"
Jendabal said with a small shrug, "Why go into details? The less the table knows, the less the anti-mules are likely to attempt to disturb it." He said it as though the safety of the table was his prime concern. He filled his mind with that and let it show. It would flatter them. More than that, the satisfaction it would bring might keep them from wondering whether, in fact, Jendabal knew exactly what it was he intended to do. 38. The first speaker spoke to Jendabal alone that evening.
"You are right," he said. "I could not help brushing below the surface of your mind. I saw you considered the announcement a mistake, and it was. It was my eagerness to wipe that eternal smile off her face, and to strike back at the casual way in which she so frequently usurps my role."
Jendabal said gently, "It might have been better if you had told me privately, and had then waited for my return to go further."
"That would not have allowed me to strike out at her. Poor motivation for a first speaker, I know."
"This won't stop her, first speaker. She will still intrigue for the post, and perhaps with good reason. I'm sure there are some who would argue that I should have refused your nomination. It would not be hard to argue that Speaker Delarmy has the best mind at the table, and would make the best first speaker."
"The best mind at the table, not away from it," grumbled Chandis. "She recognizes no real enemies, except for other speakers. She ought never to have been made a speaker in the first place. See here, shall I forbid you to take the Hamish woman? She maneuvered you into that, I know."
"No, no. The reason I advance for taking her is a true one. She will be an early warning system, and I am grateful to Speaker Delarmy for pushing me into realizing that. The woman will prove very useful, I'm convinced."
"Good, then. By the way, I wasn't lying either. I am truly certain that you will accomplish whatever is needed to end this crisis, if you can trust my intuition."
"I think I can trust it, for I agree with you. I promise you that whatever happens, I will return better than I receive. I will come back to be first speaker, whatever the anti-mules or Speaker Delarmy can do."
Jendabal studied his own satisfaction even as he spoke. Why was he so pleased, so insistent on this one-ship venture into space? Ambition, of course. Preem Palver had once done just this sort of thing, and he was going to show that Stor Jendabal could do it too. No one could withhold the first speakership from him after that. And yet, was there more than ambition? The lure of combat? The generalized desire for excitement in one who had been confined to a hidden patch on a backward planet all his adult life? He didn't entirely know, but he knew he was desperately intent on going.
Chapter 11. Seychelles. 39. Jenov Pellerat watched, for the first time in his life, as the bright star graduated into an orb after what Trevise had called a micro-jump. The fourth planet, the habitable one, and their immediate destination, Seychelles, then grew in size and prominence more slowly, over a period of days. A map of the planet had been produced by the computer, and was displayed on a portable screening device which Pellerat held in his lap.
Trevise, with the aplomb of someone who had in his time touched down upon several dozen worlds, said, "Don't start watching too hard too soon, Genoff. We have to go through the entry station first, and that can be tedious." Pellaret looked up.
"Surely that's just a formality."
"It is, but it can still be tedious."
"But it's peacetime."
"Of course. That means we'll be passed through. First, though, there's a little matter of the ecological balance. Every planet has its own, and they don't want it upset. So they make a natural point of checking the ship for undesirable organisms or infections. It's a reasonable precaution."
"We don't have such things, it seems to me."
"No, we don't, and they'll find that out. Remember, too, that Seychelles is not a member of the Foundation Federation, so there's certain to be some leaning over backward to demonstrate their independence." A small ship came out to inspect them, and a Seychellian customs official boarded. Trevise was brisk, not having forgotten his military days. "The Far Star, out of Terminus," he said. "Ship's papers. Unarmed. Private vessel. My passport? There is one passenger. His passport. We are tourists." The customs official wore a garish uniform in which crimson was the dominating color. Cheeks and upper lip were smooth-shaven, but he wore a short beard, parted in such a way that tufts thrust out to both sides of his chin. He said, "Foundation ship." He pronounced it, "Foundation ship." But Trevise was careful neither to correct him nor to smile. There were as many varieties of dialects to galactic standard as there were planets, and you just spoke your own. As long as there was cross-comprehension, it didn't matter. "Yes, sir," said Trevise. "Foundation ship, privately owned."
"Very nice. Your leading, if you please."
"My what?"
"Your leading. What are you carrying?"
"Ah, my cargo. Here is the itemized list. Personal property only. We are not here to trade. As I told you, we are simply tourists." "Ah, my cargo. Here is the itemized list. Personal property only. We are not here to trade. As I told you, we are simply tourists." The customs official looked about curiously.
"This is rather an elaborate vessel for tourists."
"Not by Foundation standards," said Trevise with a display of good humor, "and I'm well off and can afford this."
"Are you suggesting that I might be vitrified?"
The official looked at him briefly, then looked away. Trevise hesitated a moment in order to interpret the meaning of the word, then another moment to decide his course of action. He said, "No, it is not my intention to bribe you. I have no reason to bribe you, and you don't look like the kind of person who could be bribed, if that were my intention. You can look over the ship if you wish."
"No need," said the official, putting away his pocket recorder. "You have already been examined for specific contraband infection and have passed. The ship has been assigned radio wavelength, will serve as an approach beam."
He left. The whole procedure had taken 15 minutes. Pellaret said in a low voice,
"Could he have made trouble? Did he really expect a bribe?"
Trevise shrugged. "Tipping the customs man is as old as the galaxy, and I would have done it readily if he had made a second try for it. As it is, well, I presume he prefers not to take a chance with a Foundation ship, and a fancy one at that. The old mayor, bless her cross-grained hide, said the name of the Foundation would protect us wherever we went, and she wasn't wrong. It could have taken a great deal longer."
"Why? He seemed to find out what he wanted to know."
"Yes, but he was courteous enough to check us by remote radio scanning. If he had wished, he could have gone over the ship with a hand machine and taken hours. He could have put us both in a field hospital and kept us days."
"What? Oh, my dear fellow!"
"Don't get excited. He didn't do it. I thought he might, but he didn't. Which means we're free to land. I'd like to go down gravitically, which could take us 15 minutes. But I don't know where the permitted landing sites might be, and I don't want to cause trouble. That means we'll have to follow the radio beam, which will take hours, as we spiral down through the atmosphere." Pellaret looked cheerful.
"But that's excellent, Golan. Will we be going slowly enough to watch the terrain?"
He held up his portable view screen with the map spread out on it at low magnification. "After a fashion. We'd have to get beneath the cloud deck, and we'll be moving at a few kilometers per second. It won't be ballooning through the atmosphere, but you'll spot the planetography."
"Excellent, excellent,"
Trevise said thoughtfully. "I'm wondering, though, if we'll be on Seychelles planet long enough to make it worth our while to adjust the ship's clock to local time."
"It depends on what we plan to do, I suppose. What do you think we'll be doing, Golan?"
"Our job is to find Gaia, and I don't know how long that will take." Pellaret said,
"We can adjust our wrist strips and leave the ship's clock as is."
"Good enough," said Trevise. He looked down at the planet spreading broadly beneath them. "No use waiting any longer. I'll adjust the computer to our assigned radio beam, and it can use the gravitics to mimic conventional flight. So, let's go down, Genoff, and see what we can find." He stared at the planet thoughtfully as the ship began to move on its smoothly adjusted gravitational potential curve. Trevise had never been in the Seychelles Union,
but he knew that over the last century it had been steadfastly unfriendly to the Foundation. He was surprised and a little dismayed they had gotten through customs so quickly. It didn't seem reasonable. 40. The customs official's name was Jogaroth Sabhadarta, and he had been serving on the station on and off for half his life. He didn't mind the life, for it gave him a chance 1 month out of three to view his books, to listen to his music, and to be away from his wife and growing son. Of course, during the last 2 years, the current head of customs had been a dreamer, which was irritating. There is no one so insufferable as a person who gives no other excuse for a peculiar action than saying he had been directed to it in a dream. Personally, Sabhadarta had decided he believed none of it, though he was careful not to say so aloud, since most people on Seychelles rather disapproved of anti-psychic doubts. To become known as a materialist might put his forthcoming pension at risk. He stroked the two tufts of hair at his chin, one with his right hand and the other with his left, cleared his throat rather loudly, and then, with inappropriate casualness, said, "Was that the ship head?" The head, who bore the equally Seychellian name of Namarath Gadsivata, was concerned with a matter involving some computer-borne data and did not look up.
"What ship?" he said.
"The Far Star, the Foundation ship, the one I just sent past, the one that was holographed from every angle. Was that the one you dreamed of?"
Gadsivata looked up now. He was a small man, with eyes that were almost black and were surrounded by fine wrinkles that had not been produced by any penchant for smiling. He said,
"Why do you ask?"
Sabhadarta straightened up and allowed his dark and luxuriant eyebrows to approach each other.
"They said they were tourists, but I've never seen a ship like that before, and my own opinion is they're Foundation agents."
Gadsivata sat back in his chair.
"See here, my man, try as I might, I cannot recall asking for your opinion."
"But, Head, I consider it my patriotic duty to point out that..."
Gadsivata crossed his arms over his chest and stared hard at the underling, who, though much the more impressive in physical stature and bearing, allowed himself to droop and take on a somehow bedraggled appearance under the gaze of his superior. Gadsivata said,
"My man, if you know what is good for you, you will do your job without comment, or I'll see to it that there will be no pension when you retire, which will be soon if I hear any more on a subject that does not concern you."
In a low voice, Sabhadarta said,
"Yes, sir."
Then, with a suspicious degree of subservience in his voice, he added,
"Is it within the range of my duty, sir, to report that a second ship is in range of our screens?"
"Consider it reported,"
Gadsivata said irritably, returning to his work.
"With," Sabhadarta, even more humbly, "characteristics very similar to the one I just sent through."
Gadsivata placed his hands on the desk and lifted himself to his feet.
"A second one?"
Sabhadarta smiled inwardly. That sanguinary person, born of an irregular union, he was referring to the head, had clearly not dreamed of two ships. He said,
"Apparently, sir, I will now return to my post and await orders, and I hope, sir..."
"Yes?"
Sabhadarta could not resist, pension risk notwithstanding.
"And I hope, sir, we didn't send the wrong one through."
41. The Far Star moved rapidly across the face of Seychelles Planet, and Pellerat watched with fascination. The cloud layer was thinner and more scattered than upon Terminus, and precisely as the map showed, the land surfaces were more compact and extensive, including broader desert areas to judge by the rusty color of much of the continental expanse. There were no signs of anything living. It seemed a world of sterile desert, gray plain, of endless wrinkles that might have represented mountainous areas, and, of course, of ocean.
"It looks lifeless," muttered Pellerat.
"You don't expect to see any life signs at this height," said Trevise. "As we get lower, you'll see the land turn green in patches. Before that, in fact, you'll see the twinkling landscape on the night side. Human beings have a penchant for lighting their worlds when darkness falls. I've never heard of a world that's an exception to that rule. In other words, the first sign of life you'll see will not only be human, but technological." Pellerat said thoughtfully,
"Human beings are diurnal in nature, after all. It seems to me that among the very first tasks of a developing technology would be the conversion of night to day. In fact, if a world lacked technology and developed one, you ought to be able to follow the progress of technological development by the increase in light upon the darkened surface. How long would it take, do you suppose, to go from uniform darkness to uniform light?"
Trevise laughed. "You have odd thoughts, but I suppose that comes from being a mythologist. I don't think a world would ever achieve a uniform glow. Night light would follow the pattern of population density, so that the continents would spark in knots and strings. Even Trantor, at its height, when it was one huge structure, let light escape that structure only at scattered points." The land turned green, as Trevise had predicted, and on the last circling of the globe, he pointed out markings that he said were cities. It's not a very urban world. I've never been in the Seychelles Union before, but according to the information the computer gives me, they tend to cling to the past. Technology, in the eyes of all the galaxy, has been associated with the Foundation, and wherever the Foundation is unpopular, there is a tendency to cling to the past. Except, of course, as far as weapons of war are concerned. I assure you, Seychelles is quite modern in that respect.
Dear me, Golan, this is not going to be unpleasant, is it? We are Foundationers, after all, and being in enemy territory...
It's not enemy territory, Janov. They'll be perfectly polite, never fear. The Foundation just isn't popular, that's all. Seychelles is not part of the Foundation Federation. Therefore, because they're proud of their independence, and because they don't like to remember that they are much weaker than the Foundation, and remain independent only because we're willing to let them remain so, they indulge in the luxury of disliking us.
I fear it will still be unpleasant, then, said Pallarat despondently.
Not at all, said Trevise. Come on, Janov. I'm talking about the official attitude of the Seychellian government. The individual people on the planet are just people, and if we're pleasant and don't act as though we're lords of the galaxy, they'll be pleasant, too. We're not coming to Seychelles in order to establish Foundation mastery. We're just tourists, asking the kind of questions about Seychelles that any tourist would ask. And we can have a little legitimate relaxation, too, if the situation permits. There's nothing wrong with staying here a few days and experiencing what they have to offer. They may have an interesting culture, interesting scenery, interesting food, and, if all else fails, interesting women. We have money to spend.
Pallarat frowned. Oh, my dear chap.
Come on, said Trevise, you're not that old. Wouldn't you be interested?
Well, I don't say there wasn't a time when I played that role properly, but surely this isn't the time for it. We have a mission. We want to reach Gaia. I have nothing against a good time, I really don't, but if we start involving ourselves, it might be difficult to pull free.
He shook his head and said mildly, I think you feared that I might have too good a time at the Galactic Library on Trantor and would be unable to pull free. Surely, what the library is to me, an attractive, dark-eyed damsel, or five or six, might be to you.
Trevise said, I'm not a rakehell, Janov, but I have no intention of being ascetic either.
Very well, I promise you we'll get on with this business of Gaia, but if something pleasant comes my way, there's no reason in the galaxy I ought not to respond normally.
If you'll just put Gaia first...
I will. Just remember, though, don't tell anyone we're from the Foundation. They'll know we are, because we've got Foundation credits and we speak with strong Terminus accents. But if we say nothing about it, they can pretend we are placeless strangers and be friendly. If we make a point of being Foundationers, they will speak politely enough, but they will tell us nothing, show us nothing, take us nowhere, and leave us strictly alone.
Pallarat sighed. I will never understand people.
There's nothing to it. All you have to do is take a close look at yourself, and you will understand everyone else. We're in no way different ourselves. How would Selden have worked out his plan, and I don't care how subtle his mathematics was, if he didn't understand people? And how could he have done that if people weren't easy to understand? You show me someone who can't understand people, and I'll show you someone who has built up a false image of himself. No offense intended.
None taken. I'm willing to admit I'm inexperienced and that I've spent a rather self-centered and constricted life. It may be that I've never really taken a good look at myself. So I'll let you be my guide and advisor where people are concerned.
Good. Then take my advice now and just watch the scenery. We'll be landing soon, and I assure you, you'll feel nothing. The computer and I will take care of everything.
Golan, don't be annoyed. If a young woman should...
Forget it. Just let me take care of the landing. Pallarat turned to look at the world at the end of the ship's contracting spiral. It would be the first foreign world upon which he would ever stand. The thought somehow filled him with foreboding, despite the fact that all the millions of inhabited planets in the galaxy had been colonized by people who had not been born upon them. All but one, he thought with a shudder of trepidation, delight. 42. The spaceport was not large by Foundation standards, but it was well kept. Trevise watched the far star moved into a berth and locked in place. They were given an elaborate coded receipt.
Pallarat said in a low voice, Do we just leave it here?
Trevise nodded and placed his hand on the other's shoulder in reassurance. Don't worry, he said in an equally low voice. They stepped into the ground car they had rented, and Trevise plugged in the map of the city, whose towers he could see on the horizon. Seychelles City, he said, the capital of the planet. City, planet, star, all named Seychelles.
I'm worried about the ship, insisted Pallarat.
Nothing to worry about, said Trevise. We'll be back tonight, because it will be our sleeping quarters if we have to stay here more than a few hours. You have to understand, too, that there's an interstellar code of spaceport ethics that, as far as I know,
has never been broken, even in wartime. Spaceships that come in peace are inviolate. If that were not so, no one would be safe, and trade would be impossible. Any world on which that code was broken would be boycotted by the space pilots of the galaxy. I assure you, no world would risk that. Besides, I've arranged with the computer that anyone who doesn't look and sound like one of us will be killed if he or she tries to board the ship. I've taken the liberty of explaining that to the port commander. I told him very politely that I would love to turn off that particular facility out of deference to the reputation that the Seychelles City spaceports hold for absolute integrity and security throughout the galaxy, I said. But the ship is a new model, and I didn't know how to turn it off. He didn't believe that, surely. Of course not. But he had to pretend he did, as otherwise he would have no choice but to be insulted. And since there would be nothing he could do about that, being insulted would only lead to humiliation. And since he didn't want that, the simplest path to follow was to believe what I said. And that's another example of how people are? Yes. You'll get used to this. How do you know this ground car isn't bugged? I thought it might be. So when they offered me one, I took another one at random. If they're all bugged, well, what have we been saying that's so terrible? Pellerat looked unhappy. I don't know how to say this. It seems rather impolite to complain, but I don't like the way it smells. There's an odor. In the ground car? Well, in the spaceport, to begin with. I suppose that's the way spaceports smell, but the ground car carries the odor with it. Could we open the windows? Treves laughed. I suppose I could figure out which portion of the control panel will do that trick, but it won't help. This planet stinks. Is it very bad? Well, it's not very strong, but it's noticeable and somewhat repulsive. Does the whole world smell this way? I keep forgetting you've never been on another world. Every inhabited world has its own odor. It's the general vegetation, mostly, though I suppose the animals and even the human beings contribute. As far as I know, nobody ever likes the smell of any world when he first lands on it. But you'll get used to it, Genoff. In a few hours, I promise you won't notice. Surely you don't mean that all worlds smell like this? No. As I said, each has its own. If we really paid attention, or if our noses were a little keener, like those of an Acreonian dog's, we could probably tell which world we were on with one sniff. When I first entered the Navy, I could never eat the first day on a new world. Then I learned the old spacer trick of sniffing a handkerchief with the world scent on it during the landing. By the time you get out into the open world, you don't smell it. And after a while, you get hardened to the whole thing. You just learn to disregard it. The worst of it is returning home, in fact. Why? Do you think Terminus doesn't smell? Are you telling me it does? Of course it does. Once you get acclimated to the smell of another world, such as Seychelles, you'll be surprised at the stench of Terminus. In the old days, whenever the locks opened on Terminus after a sizable tour of duty, all the crew would call out, "Back home to the crap." Pellerat looked revolted. The towers of the city were perceptibly closer, but Pellerat kept his eyes fixed on their immediate surroundings. There were other ground cars moving in both directions, and an occasional air car above, but Pellerat was studying the trees. He said, "The plant life seems strange. Do you suppose any of it is indigenous?" "I doubt it," said Treves absently. He was studying the map and attempting to adjust the programming of the car's computer. "There's not much in the way of indigenous life on any human planet. Settlers always imported their own plants and animals, either at the time of settling or not too long afterward." "It seems strange, though." "You don't expect the same varieties from world to world, Janoff. I was once told that the Encyclopedia Galactica people put out an atlas of varieties which ran to 87 fat computer disks and was incomplete even so, and outdated anyway by the time it was finished." The ground car moved on, and the outskirts of the city gaped and engulfed them. Pellerat shivered slightly. "I don't think much of their city architecture." "To each his own," said Treves with the indifference of the seasoned space traveler. "Where are we going, by the way?" "Well," said Treves with a certain exasperation, "I'm trying to get the computer to guide this thing to the tourist center. I hope the computer knows the one-way streets and the traffic regulations, because I don't."
"What do we do there, Golan?"
"To begin with, we're tourists, so that's the place where we'd naturally go, and we want to be as inconspicuous and natural as we can. And secondly, where would you go to get information on Gaia?" Pellerat said,
"To a university, or an anthropological society, or a museum. Certainly not to a tourist center."
"Well, you're wrong. At the tourist center, we will be intellectual types who are eager to have a listing of the universities in the city and the museums and so on. We'll decide where to go first, and there we may find the proper people to consult concerning ancient history, galactography, mythology, anthropology, or anything else you can think of. But the whole thing starts at the tourist center." Pellerat was silent.
and the ground car moved on in a tortuous manner as it joined and became part of the traffic pattern. They plunged into a subroad and drove past signs that might have represented directions and traffic instructions, but were in a style of lettering that made them all but unreadable. Fortunately, the ground car behaved as though it knew the way, and when it stopped and drew itself into a parking spot, there was a sign that said, Seychelles Outworld Milieu, in the same difficult printing, and under it, Seychelles Tourist Center, in straightforward, easy-to-read galactic standard lettering. They walked into the building, which was not as large as the facade had led them to believe. It was certainly not busy inside. There were a series of waiting booths, one of which was occupied by a man reading the news strips emerging from a small ejector. Another contained two women who seemed to be playing some intricate game with cards and tiles. Behind a counter too large for him, with winking computer controls that seemed far too complex for him, was a bored-looking Seychellian functionary wearing what looked like a multicolored checkerboard. Pellerat stared and whispered, "This is certainly a world of extroverted garb." "Yes," said Trevise, "I noticed. Still, fashions change from world to world, and even from region to region within a world sometimes, and they change with time. 50 years ago, everyone on Seychelles might have worn black, for all we know. Take it as it comes, Genoff."
"I suppose I'll have to," said Pellerat, "but I prefer our own fashions. At least, they're not an assault upon the optic nerve."
"Because so many of us are gray on gray? That offends some people. I've heard it referred to as dressing in dirt. Then, too, it's foundation colorlessness that probably keeps these people in their rainbows, just to emphasize their independence. It's all what you're accustomed to, anyway. Come on, Genoff." The two headed toward the counter, and as they did so, the man in the booth forsook his news items, rose, and came to meet them, smiling as he did so. His clothing was in shades of gray. Trevise didn't look in his direction first, but when he did, he stopped dead. He took a deep breath. "By the galaxy, my friend the traitor." Chapter 12. Agent. 43. Mun Li Kampor, councilman of Terminus, looked uncertain as he extended his right hand to Trevise. Trevise looked at the hand sternly and did not take it. He said apparently to open air, "I am in no position to create a situation in which I may find myself arrested for disturbing the peace on a foreign planet, but I will do so anyway if this individual comes a step closer." Kampor stopped abruptly, hesitated, and finally said in a low voice after glancing uncertainly at Pellerat,
"Am I to have a chance to talk, to explain? Will you listen?"
Pellerat looked from one to the other with a slight frown on his long face. He said,
"What's all this, Golan? Have we come to this far world and at once met someone you know?"
Trevise's eyes remained firmly fixed on Kampor, but he twisted his body slightly to make it clear that he was talking to Pellerat. Trevise said, "This human being, we would judge that much from his shape, was once a friend of mine on Terminus. As is my habit with my friends, I trusted him. I told him my views, which were perhaps not the kind that should have received a general airing. He told him through the authorities in great detail, apparently, and did not take the trouble to tell me he had done so. For that reason, I walked neatly into a trap, and now I find myself in exile. And now this human being wishes to be recognized as a friend." He turned to Kampor full on and brushed his fingers through his hair, succeeding only in disarranging the curls further. "See here, you. I do have a question for you. What are you doing here? Of all the worlds in the galaxy on which you could be, why are you on this one, and why now?" Kampor's hand, which had remained outstretched throughout Trevise's speech, now fell to his side, and the smile left his face. The air of self-confidence, which was ordinarily so much a part of him, was gone, and in its absence he looked younger than his 34 years and a bit woebegone.
"I'll explain," he said, "but only from the start."
Trevise looked about briefly. "Here? You really want to talk about it here, in a public place? You want me to knock you down here after I've listened to enough of your lies?" Kampor lifted both hands now, palms facing each other.
"It's the safest place, believe me."
And then, checking himself and realizing what the other was about to say, added hurriedly,
"Oh, don't believe me. It doesn't matter. I'm telling the truth. I've been on the planet several hours longer than you, and I've checked it out. This is some particular day they have here on Seychelles. It's a day for meditation, for some reason. Almost everyone is at home, or should be. You see how empty this place is. You don't suppose it's like this every day?"
Pellerat nodded and said,
"I was wondering why it was so empty at that."
He leaned toward Trevise's ear and whispered,
"Why not let him talk, Golan? He looks miserable, poor chap, and he may be trying to apologize. It seems unfair not to give him the chance to do so."
Trevise said, "Dr. Pellerat seems anxious to hear you. I'm willing to oblige him, but you'll oblige me if you're brief about it."
This may be a good day on which to lose my temper. If everyone is meditating, any disturbance I cause may not produce the guardians of the law. I may not be so lucky tomorrow. Why waste an opportunity? Kampor said in a strained voice, Look, if you want to take a poke at me, do so. I won't even defend myself. See? Go ahead, hit me, but listen. Go ahead and talk, then. I'll listen for a while. In the first place, Golan, address me as Trevise, please. I am not on first-name terms with you. In the first place, Trevise, you did too good a job convincing me of your views. You hid that well. I could have sworn you were amused by me. I tried to be amused to hide from myself the fact that you were being extremely disturbing. Look, let us sit down up against the wall. Even if the place is empty, some few may come in, and I don't think we ought to be needlessly conspicuous. Slowly, the three men walked most of the length of the large room. Kampor was smiling tentatively again, but remained carefully at more than arm's length from Trevise. They sat, each on a seat, that gave as their weight was placed upon it, and molded itself into the shape of their hips and buttocks. Pellerat looked surprised and made as though to stand up. "Relax, Professor," said Kampor. "I've been through this already. They're in advance of us in some ways. It's a world that believes in small comforts." He turned to Trevise, placing one arm over the back of his chair and speaking easily now. "You disturbed me. You made me feel the second foundation did exist, and that was deeply upsetting. Consider the consequences if they did. Wasn't it likely that they might take care of you somehow, remove you as a menace? And if I behaved as though I believed you, I might be removed as well. Do you see my point?" "I see a coward." "What good would it do to be storybook brave?" said Kampor warmly, his blue eyes widening in indignation. "Can you or I stand up to an organization capable of molding our minds and emotions? The only way we could fight effectively would be to hide our knowledge to begin with." "So you did it and were safe? Yet you didn't hide it from Mayor Brano, did you? Quite a risk there." "Yes, but I thought that was worth it. Just talking between ourselves might do nothing more than get ourselves mentally controlled, or our memories erased altogether. If I told the mayor, on the other hand, she knew my father well, you know. My father and I were immigrants from Smyrna, and the mayor had a grandmother who..." "Yes, yes," said Trevise impatiently. "And several generations farther back, you can trace ancestry to the Syria sector. You've told all that to everyone you know. Get on with it, Kampor."
"Well, I had her ear. If I could convince the mayor that there was danger using your arguments, the Federation might take some action. We're not as helpless as we were in the days of the mule, and, at the worst, this dangerous knowledge would be spread more widely, and we ourselves would not be in as much specific danger."
Trevise said sardonically, "Endanger the Foundation, but keep ourselves safe. That's good patriotic stuff." "That would be at the worst. I was counting on the best." His forehead had become a little damp. He seemed to be straining against Trevise's immovable contempt. "And you didn't tell me of this clever plan of yours, did you?"
"No, I didn't. And I'm sorry about that, Trevise. The mayor ordered me not to. She said she wanted to know everything you knew, but that you were the sort of person who would freeze if you knew that your remarks were being passed on."
"How right she was."
"I didn't know. I couldn't guess. I had no way of conceiving that she was planning to arrest you and throw you off the planet.
She was waiting for the right political moment when my status as councilman would not protect me. You didn't foresee that?"
"How could I? You yourself did not."
"Had I known that she knew my views, I would have." Kampor said with a sudden trace of insolence,
"That's easy enough to say, in hindsight."
"And what is it you want of me here, now that you have a bit of hindsight, too?"
"To make up for all this. To make up for the harm I unwittingly did you."
"Goodness," said Trevise dryly, "how kind of you. But you haven't answered my original question. How did you come to be here? How do you happen to be on the very planet I am on?" Kampor said,
"There's no complicated answer necessary for that. I followed you."
"Through hyperspace, with my ship making jumps in series?" Kampor shook his head.
"No mystery. I have the same kind of ship you do, with the same kind of computer. You know, I've always had this trick of being able to guess in which direction, through hyperspace, a ship would go. It's not usually a very good guess, and I'm wrong 2 times out of 3. But with the computer, I'm much better. And you hesitated quite a bit at the start, and gave me a chance to evaluate the direction and speed in which you are going before entering hyperspace. I fed the data, together with my own intuitive extrapolations, into the computer, and it did the rest."
"And you actually got to the city ahead of me?"
"Yes. You didn't use gravitics, and I did. I guessed you would come to the capital city, so I went straight down, while you..."
Kampor made a short spiral motion with his finger, as though it were a ship riding a directional beam. "You took a chance on a run-in with Seychelles and officialdom?"
"Well..."
Kampor's face broke into a smile that lent it an undeniable charm, and Trevise felt himself almost warming to him. Kampor said, I'm not a coward at all times and in all things.
Trevise steeled himself. How did you happen to get a ship like mine?
In precisely the same way you got a ship like yours. The old lady, Mayor Brano, assigned it to me.
Why?
I'm being entirely frank with you. My assignment was to follow you. The mayor wanted to know where you were going and what you would be doing.